think in that moment when I was just so anxious, I just had to calm everything down and just go back to a mantra of, this is okay, calm, relax, you're fine. This is okay, calm, relax, you're fine. And just had to keep repeating that for a few moments. And then just once I kind of made myself calm, then maybe take a few more steps forward. So I think it's just about trying to really relax your mind and just have one sentence in your mind that's telling yourself, okay, this is okay. It's all going to be okay. And rather than all those various questions.
Welcome to No Finish Line, a podcast with John O'Regan, sponsored by Great Outdoors Dublin.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of No Finish Line podcast, featuring athlete interviews and discussion on running, training, travelling and adventure. And this week I'm talking about the Trans-Sahara Marathon. This is something I tried to do a podcast on previously, but it didn't work out too well. I posted it as a rough edit. That was done just after I'd finished the race and I was in Marrakesh. I was trying to just go from immediate memory of the race, but I think I was a little bit too fatigued. And then because Sinead was so close at the time, she wasn't fully aware of the extent of her injury and I didn't want to be talking about it too much, so I shelved that to the side. So when you start listening to this podcast, it's a bit slow to start because, again, not fully prepared for it. And I wanted to get something done and I was involving Sinead in a little bit of the chat. So I think the podcast did go quite well. We talked about resilience, mindset, teamwork, goal setting. We talk a little bit about the gear. And we talk a bit about the actual race itself. Now, the Trans-Sahara Marathon is a four-day multi-stage race in the Sahara Desert. It's organised by Mohamed Ahansel, and he's one of the most knowledgeable guys out there. He puts on a fantastic race. I found this one to be great value, actually. I don't know how a profit is being made out of it. And it's a race that I would highly recommend for anybody who's interested in trying a multi-stage desert race. It has a little bit more comfort than the Marathon des Sables in that you don't have to carry all your personal equipment with you. That's done for you. Meals are provided and you also get transport from Marrakesh to the race venue. And again, you get transfers back and there was some hotel accommodation thrown in. You get to experience a lot of the local culture. It's local people who are involved in the race logistics itself. So I think by doing a race like this, you were actually supporting the local economy as well. And having been to the desert before, I've been to Marrakesh three times, been inside the desert twice. I think this race here showed me some new experiences. I got to, I suppose, see a lot of what the desert has to offer. I got to see oases, dried up rivers, cross mountains, amazing sand dunes, past camel herders, went by the home of a nomad family and just got to see some amazing landscape. So I would highly recommend this type of race. So here we go with the podcast and hope you enjoy. So remember, just if you don't like the first part of it, maybe fast forward for a minute or two, but I do think that it's worth listening to for anyone who's interested in multi-stage racing or adventure racing. Hello and welcome back to another episode of No Finish Line podcast. And today I'm going to try and redo the podcast that I had tried to do warming over Morocco after the Trans-Sahara Marathon. We had just come back from the desert. We were in Marrakesh. We were recovering and I tried to go from memory and describe what we'd actually been through, and maybe I was kind of overthinking it a bit, so I'm going to, rather than talk about too much, I'll just go through the actual race itself and then I can do some travel tips and stuff like that towards the end of it or else in another podcast. And Sinead is here with me, so she might actually join in to add in a few bits and pieces where I might have forgot, but for the moment she's just going to stay quiet and just listen in. Hello, Sinead.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Okay, for starters, what is the Trans-Sahara Marathon? The Trans-Saharan Marathon is a multi-stage desert race. It would be similar to the Marathon des Sables, which is the one that everybody knows. The Marathon des Sables goes on for 7 days, covers 256 kilometres, and during the race, competitors need to be self-sufficient, carrying all their personal belongings that they will need for the duration of the race. That includes their food and all their equipment, sleeping bag, sleeping mat, bag to carry it in, something to cook the food in, first aid kit, an emergency flare, and then they're given a certain amount of water per day. In the Trans-Saharan Marathon, competitors weren't required to be as self-sufficient. We did have to carry a bag each day, which contained our mandatory kit, but we didn't need to transfer our sleeping bag or sleeping mat or spare clothes between the camps. That was actually done for us. So that did help lighten the load. But from recollection, I would say that it was a very challenging race. It allowed for faster movement and the terrain was a lot more difficult. So in degrees of difficulty, you have to kind of balance things out when you're looking at carrying more gear versus the actual intensity and the terrain over the day. It does actually balance itself out that way. So the race itself started just outside a town called Zagora. We flew into Marrakesh and we had, I think it was a 6 to 8 hour journey from Marrakesh to Zagora. We were supposed to stop in a town called Wazirat, which is where the Marathon des Sables starts from, but we were delayed in Marrakesh for an extra day because of heavy snowfall in the mountain. So the mountain pass was actually closed off. So not something you expect to hear when you're going doing a desert race. So that meant that we were missing a day, so we had to bypass Wazirat and go directly to Zagora. So it was quite a long journey with a couple of personal lead stops on the way. Stopped at some cafes, had lunch, had coffee. And then we got to Zagora, a big small town, whatever you want to call it, in the desert. We travelled through it and we then pulled off the side of the road and we swapped over from the minibus into some four-wheel drive vehicles and then we were transported to Camp Ahansel. It's named after Muhammad Ahansel, who runs the camp, and he is a multi-winner of the Marathon des Sables. He's probably one of the most famous desert runners in the country, maybe in the world. So we had a day or two acclimatising in the camp. We got to know the other competitors. We had a communal tent whereby we had our meals and briefings and we had our medical checks and our gear checks inside there as well. Then we were allocated our own tent, which had electricity during daylight hours. I think the electricity was switched off then just shortly after sunset. But there was plenty of room in the tent. It was very, very comfortable. We had a bed, we had a mattress. We just needed to use our sleeping bag. But there's plenty of room to walk around. You could put your hands over your head and still not touch the ceiling. So very, very comfortable. We also had some access to basic showers, basic toilets, and washing facilities. So all in all, the camp was very, very comfortable. So the first, I think we had 2 or 3 days in the camp. And during that time, myself and Sinead and some of the other competitors, we used the opportunity to do some acclimatising runs, get used to running in the environment, try out our bags with our kit packed in, and just to kind of see what was comfortable and what way would be best to actually carry your bags and what kind of pace that we could expect to be running during the race. Race day came and the first day was a loop back to the actual camp. So we were able to leave most of our gear there. We didn't need to worry about packing up. So we had a little bit of comfort and this was a great way of actually acclimatising into the environment. The race started and we did a loop inside the camp. I think the loop was about 1 kilometre, maybe less than that, where we ran away from the camp back towards the road where the 4x4s brought us in. Went over a couple of small sand dunes. And this small loop was a very, very fast pace. And I know I could feel it and I knew my bag was kind of moving around a bit more. I was moving faster than what I was expecting to be moving. Then we come back into the camp with a small but steep climb over sand dune. And then once we got through the camp and away from the race organisers and the spectators, things started to settle down a bit. The terrain to start off was fairly flat, a lot of small rocks. And then we started to get deeper into the desert and it was just rocks. Everywhere we went was just rocks. So it was almost like walking across a ploughed potato field that the potatoes were still waiting to be picked, and it was just rocks everywhere. So that was very mentally draining and time consuming, trying to find our way through these fields of rocks. We could see then the first aid station, which was a Land Rover with two of the race organisers. We went to the aid station, stocked up on water. I knew Sinead was kind of glad of that break. Her shoulders were killing her from using the poles. And then we went from there towards a kind of open mountain. We went around, traversed around the side of the open mountain, and we were able to move a little bit quicker than we had been moving. And Sinead was starting to relax a bit more into it. And then the unexpected happened. Sinead kicked a rock, she fell forward, and she hit her knee off a rock. Of course, there were rocks everywhere. So I heard Sinead let out a scream. I knew something was really, really bad. And at the time, I didn't know how serious it was. Luckily, she didn't bang her head. She got her knee, her elbow, so she was kind of bruised and cut. But when I seen the wound on her knee, I knew it was actually quite serious, and I actually thought we were going to be out of the race. So we got Sinead into a sitting position. It was actually starting to rain now at this stage, so it was getting cold. And we went looking through the first aid kit, where I had to try and make the most of a bad situation with what we had. Now, first aid kit for a race of this is fairly basic, so you don't have everything that you would be able to carry if you were out in a day hill walking. So we just had to do something that was fairly improvised. But at that moment, I actually thought Sinead was out of the race, so I got the GPS tracker and I tried to call in the race organisers to tell them that we're out of the race. So I pressed the send button, and I let Sinead then wasn't too happy, so I might let Sinead just talk for a moment.
Well, I was finding the race at that point quite difficult. Just the amount of rocks. I knew from very early on that this was going to be a difficult day, and when I fell, I suppose I didn't realise how bad it was because of my visual impairment. I couldn't see, but I could feel the pain, and then I was distracted from the pain by you saying that I'm pressing the SOS button, you're out of the race, you need to get this seen to. So I think the whole thing of feeling the pain, I was more kind of distracted then by thinking, okay, well, how do I stay in this race? Like, I haven't come all the ways from Ireland just after 10 kilometre of a 4-day race to just be out after 10, 11 kilometres.
Just as you're mentioning that being out of the race, I can remember on maybe 2 days beforehand, we were out in the sand dunes and you were finding it quite challenging and you were saying, I can't do this, I can't do this. Why did you sign up for this? I don't want to be here. You felt that the race was going to be impossible. And at that point, you didn't want to do it. And then when you kicked the rock, you had a really, really bad injury. No one else would have continued running with the injury. I wouldn't have continued running with the injury. I know that for a fact. And you then had an opportunity to get out of the race, but it seemed to make you more determined. Why do you think your mindset shifted from, first of all, not wanting to do the race, and now you had a reason that you could justifiably stop doing it, but it made you want to do it even more?
I think because, I don't know, I was just thinking to myself, okay, well, I didn't want to feel like a failure, and I kind of felt like the whole reason why I fell is because of my visual impairment, because of my disability. Now, I know a fully sighted runner can fall easy enough as well. But I was kind of there to try and prove that, okay, even if you're visually impaired, you can kind of run in this terrain, even if you're quite slow at doing it. And that first 10 kilometres was a reminder to me of my disability. And so I think that's the reason why I didn't want to let the disability be the factor of as to why I was out.
Now, I'm going to stay on this incident now for the moment, because the first aid kit was something that was really, really important at that time. We had a mandatory kit list. And with a mandatory kit list, you look at carrying the absolute minimum because you try to keep weight to a minimum. I had got a lend of some kit from a friend of mine, because most of the items that I had, I've either lent them out and they've gone missing. So now I needed stuff that I didn't have. And he gave me a very neat little kit with essentials, and the stuff was just tiny. And again, it was the absolute minimum. So the first aid kit we had, we did have a first aid kit, and that's what we were told to have, and we had everything we needed. But I knew that this first aid kit wasn't enough. It's not enough for what, for when you're going into these kind of extremes. So a lot of times we look at kit lists and we look for loopholes and we exploit them. Like, a plaster isn't a first aid kit. And I think that's the kind of stuff that people will be looking at. If you're asked to carry a sleeping mat and somebody carries a piece of cardboard, that's not really going to insulate you from the ground to give you a good night's sleep. So a lot of times we look for shortcuts and we look for loopholes, but there's some things you can't really scrimp on, and it's when something happens, you can't just buy your way out of a problem. What you have is what you have. When you're in the middle of the desert, if you don't have the essential items to help you survive, you're in trouble. Now, I think in my case, I did have a decent enough first aid kit, but I didn't have everything to cover all the possible scenarios of what could have happened. One of the things I was missing was a triangular bandage. And I think the reason I left that out was because my first aid kit wasn't closing, my little first aid kit pouch. But my experience got me to cut up a buff, and I was able to make a bandage. So I was able to improvise and do something that got us out of that situation. But in hindsight, I think I would not be looking for the same loopholes anymore. So when you're looking at a mandatory kit list, make sure you have that, you have what's required. It's there for a reason. We got moving. Sinead had a set of walking poles, and we had at least 2 kilometres to go before we reached the next checkpoint. We didn't know if there was anybody behind us. We did know that there were people ahead of us. They were out of reach, out of sight, so we couldn't see them to get an eyeball on where they actually were or what direction we needed to travel in. So I had to pay special attention to the navigation and route selection. And once or twice we did kind of go wrong. But when you go wrong, you kind of know that you're going in the wrong direction. And I would also be looking for stuff like footprints. The terrain started to open up a bit, and I could see the checkpoint in the distance. I did mention that to Sinead, but she said, how far is it? And very, very hard to judge time and distance when the ground is so open and you can see for such a long way away. But eventually we found our way to the next checkpoint, and there was a medic. Sinead was put down onto a mat, and they cleaned out the wound and started to do a job on her knee. That was quite time consuming and painful. Sinead didn't know exactly what was happening, so I won't mention too much about it. But there is a video that I posted up on Instagram that shows what actually happened at the time. And Kojo Films have released a video that you'll find on YouTube about the Trans-Sahara Marathon, and that goes into a little bit more detail, and that shows you bits of the whole race. So when Sinead got sorted, she got her knee patched up, she got a bandage onto it, she got some painkillers. And we then got up to start moving, and Sinead was being escorted towards one of the jeeps, and she asked the question, well, why was she going over there? She thought she was finished, and they said they were bringing her back to the camp, but she didn't want to go back to the camp because she knew that would mean she was out of the race. But they told her she couldn't continue with the way her leg was, it wasn't possible. She wanted to take a chance, and we did a bit of bargaining. Well, Sinead did a bit of bargaining. I was on the side of the race medics that I want. I thought she should be out of the race as well. But we got moving. The deal was that she'd go for about 5-10 minutes, and if she felt she had to come back, she'd come back and take the Jeep. But we continued on. We caught up with a few of the other competitors. I think that seemed to help Sinead's leg loosen out a bit, and she started to move even stronger. And eventually we made it back to the camp, something that we didn't think was going to happen when we were at the side of the mountain. So immediately Sinead was brought over to the medic's tent. She had to get the bandage removed, and the wound badly needed to be cleaned up because of the amount of sand that was put into it. So she got another dressing put onto it. And that made everything that we did in the camp from then on was very, very difficult. Even for Sinead trying to sit down, it was a problem. Anything she wanted to do was difficult now, because one of her legs was immobile. It was, you know, she couldn't really flex at the knee. The leg was very, very straight as she was moving around. And we didn't know if we were going to get out the second day. The second day then was also the mountain stage, where we had to cross a very, very high mountain pass. We said we'd see how things were in the morning. Well, again, that was the compromise that Sinead was making with the race director. So the following morning, we lined up at the start line. We were moving quite well. Actually, I'm going to bring Sinead back in again just to talk about the end of the first day and the medical tent.
After the fall, as we were going towards the aid station, which was a kilometre away, when we got there, I suppose on route to there, I was self-talk with myself saying, okay, well, if you get here, if something is broken, then we'll have to assess whether to go on with this race. But if nothing is broken, then you're continuing on in the race. So that was the self-talk that I was having with myself. And so that's what I had in my head when I arrived, when they were looking at my knee and everything like that. I said to myself, okay, again, this is reassuring. We're not out in the wilderness where nobody medically qualified is not looking at your knee. So actually this is a bonus. So I started to see a positive in that. So I was using the strategies of self-talk, negotiating with myself. I was using the strategy of positive thinking, as in, okay, a qualified medical person is looking at your knee, this is fine. And then when they were at my knee, which was quite painful, I just was being patient, and I just kept using a mantra in my head. This is okay, calm, relax, you're fine, calm, relax, you're fine. That's what I just kept saying. Stay calm, it's fine, it's fine. So I just kept saying that mantra over and over to just distract myself. And then as we get up to go away, like you say, they wanted me to go into the Jeep. And at that stage, I had no intention of going into the Jeep. I just said to myself that no matter how painful this knee is, I'm finishing this. And I nearly was having like an argument in my own head amongst myself, like one side of my head telling me, okay, well, sure, it's easier now to just stop. And then the other side of the head saying, sure, why would you stop? Sure, nothing is broken. It's not like as if you've majorly damaged yourself or anything. Get a hold of yourself. Let's get moving. So I think every runner has that kind of self-talk back and forward, the good and the bad person talking in your head. So for me, it was the person who was being very motivating, that one out, who said, right, nothing is broken, get over yourself, let's get moving. And when we did get moving, what I was finding very frustrating was that the bandage kept coming off. So I started getting worried then. Not worried about finishing, because I had told myself I'm finishing this day no matter what, but just worried in case I tripped over something else. And then it was just this anxiety, okay, if I trip now again and bang this knee again, I am going to be in an extreme amount of pain. So for the rest of that race, it was just really a lot of anxiety to prevent myself from falling, because I didn't want to fall on the injured knee already. And like you said, when we got to the finish line, I was brought into the tent, and Dr. Ilias and another lady doctor was there, and the nurse was there, and the three of them were tending to my knee. And part I found very painful was when they were using liquid to actually kind of clean it. It was just stinging an awful lot. And like the doctor, Ilias, said that I had cut it in the worst place possible, because it was cut in a section where basically the foot or the knee needs to keep flexing. So every time I went to move the knee, it would flex and then it would start bleeding again. So, so that was quite difficult on the first day.
Okay, you have me thinking back to the first day again, based on what you said there. When the accident happened, you had to get your knee stitched and you have a fear of needles. How do you think you overcome that? Actually, no, don't answer that question just yet, because when we got into the second day, we had the mountain stage, and you also have a fear of heights. And then when we got to the mountain base, we actually moved quite well on this day, surprisingly enough. And part of me is thinking that you were putting on an act at the start, that you wanted to let people see that you were okay. You were trying to run as normal and get away from everyone so that they wouldn't tell you you can't continue. That's my thoughts on it. Then we came to the first aid station, which was at the foot of the mountains. And it was quite a challenging climb from there, because it was just all rocks. They weren't like steps. It was just like a waterfall of rocks that had just stopped, and we were going up that. And then the path started to zigzag, and then it became a bit more manageable, where they almost were like steps. And at times you were aware of the height that we were up, because you knew with the climb we were doing. I said you have a fear of heights, and there were one or two moments then where that actually froze you to the spot. So you've gone from the day before the race not wanting to do it because you had a fear of what was ahead. Then you started, you had then had to deal with your fear of needles. And then on day two, you have a bandaged up knee with stitches, and you're also frozen stiff on the side of a mountain, knowing that you're up a height. How do you deal with those moments?
I think in that moment where, like, my anxiety was quite high, I was having, I think, nearly a panic attack. All I kept thinking was, I'm going to die on this mountain. I just want to get down. I want to get down. I don't want to be up here. And so, again, that was all coming from a place of my own self-talk within my head. So being within my head too much, too many thoughts racing. What am I going to do if I fall off this? What am I going to do if I hit my knee again? What am I going to do if this bandage comes off? And like, there was just millions of questions going on. So I think in that moment when I was just so anxious, I just had to calm everything down and just go back to a mantra of, this is okay, calm, relax, you're fine. This is okay, calm, relax, you're fine. And just had to keep repeating that for a few moments. And then just once I kind of made myself calm, then maybe take a few more steps forward. So I think it's just about trying to really relax your mind and just have one sentence in your mind that's telling yourself, okay, this is okay, it's all going to be okay. And rather than all those various questions, I think the anxiety was quite high because, like you say, I have the fear of heights, but all I kept thinking was, okay, like when I was on kind of flatter ground the day before and I kicked a rock and I fell, what's going to happen if, because of my eyesight, I don't lift my foot high enough, or if I kick something here? All I kept thinking was, yeah, it'll be more serious up here. So yeah, again, it comes back to self-talk. And then just after the self-talk, when you calm yourself down, then I think it's about focusing on, why are you here? And I was there because I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to grow. And so then in that moment, I just kept thinking, okay, what's going to feel like at the end of today to know that this is a genuine fear that I've come over? Because when you come over a fear, you feel, you know then that you did good. You know that it has made you grow as a person. It has built your confidence. And I think that's what resilience is a lot about. It's resilience is when, if your confidence has been knocked, and my confidence had been knocked from the first day. And so I was just trying to gain my confidence back again by telling myself, well, if you can get to the end of today, then you can finish this whole race.
Well, you mentioned resilience there, and that has me thinking how some people will drop out of a race or stop what they're doing when they can continue. And then there's people who continue when really they should be stopping. And I would say that you were continuing when you should have been stopping. What do you think makes the difference between those two people? The one who will just give up, say someone who might get a blister, or someone who might just feel that it's too uncomfortable, and they tell themselves a little story, give themselves a reason to drop out, and they can justify that in their own head. What do you think makes the difference between those two people? Someone who will just continue regardless of what's there ahead of them?
I think it comes back to how badly you want your goals, though. Like, for me, obviously, if they had told me, okay, your leg is broken or your knee is broken, then I would have had to reassess. My mindset probably would have been like, well, how can I do this with a broken leg? Because that's just the type of person I am. So when you're talking about people who continue to the end, for me, it's like, how badly do you want it? And for me, I'd set myself this goal and was committed to it, and that's it. Like,
now, this had me thinking again. I'm nearly getting away from the desert, but do you think that some people think that they want their goals more than they actually do, and what they really want is something that they see somebody else doing and promoting, and they think, oh, that's me, I can do that, I want to do that, and they talk about it more than they actually practice doing it. And then when they get into the environment of actually doing it, say somebody who talks about doing a race and they don't have the experience, the running experience, they just have the mindset maybe on doing a 100-mile race. And then they go into the race and then they realise how tough it is. I'm not sure what I'm actually how to explain it, but you just have me thinking, you know, maybe this is a subject for a different day, but I think that some people don't want it as badly as they think they do. They're kind of living.
They're living somebody else's dream. Maybe, yeah, that's what you're trying to say. And
yeah, I think that's it. Read a book by someone like David Goggins, and they think that's me, and they just want to do what he's doing, but they're not putting the work in. They're not doing the 90%. They're just focused on the 2%.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of people out there, they're copycat, as in, okay, that person is doing that, I can do that, no problem. And then they actually go out and they realise, okay, actually, that person made it look easy, and I thought that it'd be easy, and I thought that I could really do it. But actually, now that I'm in it, then they figure out, okay, actually, they can't fully do it. And then they just use excuses then to come out. But I suppose in terms of me, I wasn't using anybody as a copycat to get into this environment, because I think had I even known what was ahead of me before flying out there, I don't know, would I have even fully went? Because I suppose when I thought of Trans-Sahara Marathon, all I thought of was just, oh, I'm going to be running in the sand on flat for 4 days. So that's actually all I thought I was going to be doing. But I think what I ended up experiencing was 4 different days, 4 different terrains. And yeah, I wouldn't be a good trail runner at all because of my eyesight. I don't get the opportunity to do it. I'm quite slow on it, and so that kind of environment doesn't fully suit me, so that's why I'm not trying to copycat anybody. But I understand what you're saying about how there is people out there, they see a person and they think then that they can be that person, but then and they don't put in half the amount of effort, and then they go out and they just expect it to happen for them, and it doesn't actually happen for them, because they realise then actually this is harder than it is.
And it's interesting what you mentioned there about just expecting sand. That's the experience I had when I went to the desert for the first time. And I can remember getting out of the back of a truck and thinking to myself, is this it? And that's actually the reason why it's good to travel, because you get to experience what these places are like, and it's not just sand. Now, let's get back to these mountains. So we eventually did get to the top of this mountain, and luckily, I said, we didn't have the same kind of descent on the far side, because we were at the top of a valley, and we kind of followed what would have been the tributary of a river. We could just see the way the land kind of gently took us down further into the valley as it made its way towards the river. So there's a bit of a path. We were able to walk side by side for quite a lot of it. We were moving very, very slowly. And once or twice we had to stop and allow a camel herder to pass by. Or then we got to this oasis, which was just amazing. I remember going over to the water and a lot of frogs swimming around. And then we made our way to this dried up river. It was like being in the Grand Canyon. We moved along that, which was tricky in parts because we were up quite a height. The drop off into the river would have been quite severe. And then we left the river and we went to our next aid station, which was outside the home of a nomad family, which was something quite special. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I suppose that was a marker as we were running along that kept us going in one way, because we kept saying, okay, this seems to be very, very long. There was stretches for me that just seemed very mentally draining. And because of not being able to see the beauty around, that's why it just felt very, very tiring. But I kept saying in my head, okay, just let's get to Nomad Family. And then that's another marker ticked off. And I suppose when we got there then, they had tea prepared. They had nuts and figs and everything on the table. And they're like, it's rude if you don't accept any of it. But because I couldn't see, you kind of explained to me how there was a lot of flies around the figs and around the nuts. And so then it's a difficult decision. Then do you be rude and not take it from them, or do you take it with the flies on the nuts and all that? So we took it and I just put it into my pocket. It shows you the different ways of how people live. I suppose when you're back in Ireland, like, everybody's just consumed by materialism, and then you're out there and you see how they live, and then you realise, okay, well, yeah, I think you become more grateful for different things in your life.
Yeah, that was kind of a special moment, and it does make you appreciate a lot of what you have, even the water we were carrying on our back, and water and food is also so precious in these places. And in that area there were a lot of goats, camels, and further down we got to meet some groups who were out camping in the desert, some kind of desert safaris. So we were out for a long day. I think the cutoff was 10 and a half hours for that day, which was it was 50 kilometers with 3,000 or 4,000 meters of climbing and some very, very slow moving terrain. And we made it back to the camp with 30 minutes to spare. And I can recall going across the finish line and just having a feeling of relief that I was just mentally drained. I think that was one of the most challenging days that I'd ever put in. I can remember that during that day as well, that we, at times when the terrain was okay, we tried to run a little bit, and then we'd have a mishap where you'd almost fall. We were a bit more cautious though. We managed to stop it, and then we slowed down again. But for the most part, we kept moving. I think the only time we really stopped was to take a photograph, or if we were at one of the aid stations to refuel. But apart from that, we didn't stop. We were constantly moving. and it was such a challenging day. Our camp had moved, so we went point to point this day, and we had access to a shower tent, which was a pallet, a wooden pallet that you stood on, and you had a bucket of lukewarm water and a ladle, and you used that then to wash yourself, and that was a bit of luxury at that time in the desert.
So, as you say there, on the second day, I knew at coming towards the finish line of that second day, there was mixed emotions, because negatively I kept thinking in my head, okay, I'm last, they're all waiting for me. And then some in my head was saying, oh, sure, it's okay, you have an injury, that's the only reason you're last. But to be honest, I think even if I didn't have the injury, I probably still would have been last anyway, because going up that mountain, just being visually impaired, just did not suit me. So I know some people were telling me, oh, don't worry about being last because of your injury. But to be honest, I do think I'd probably still be last on that second day. But so the negative part just kept really honing in about that, about being last. But then the positive part in the self-talk kept saying to me, well, look, you completed today. You didn't even think because of your injury or because of your vision impairment that you'd actually complete today, because that type of terrain, climbing up the mountain and all that, you're not used to that. So I suppose I felt proud of myself. And then in that moment, crossing the finishing line, I knew then that if I completed that day, then there was no doubt that I was doing day 3 and day 4, because I was so, so drained from day 2, mentally and physically, that I knew that it would be extraordinary to get harder for day 3 and day 4. So I knew then in those moments that I was going to be completing day 3 and day 4. And then you say then, when you finished, straight over to the medical tent again, because the wound was showing, because the bandage kept coming off. So over to the medical tent again to get seen. And after that, then had a shower, and you talk about the shower being luxury. Again, it really grounds you. Basically, your shower is 2 buckets. You stand into 1 bucket and then you use the other bucket to pour it over your head. And now, thankfully, the water was warm. So it would have been awful if it had been like really, really cold. But so just, I suppose, when I heard, oh yeah, there'll be showers at the end of the race, I don't know why I started visualising just your modern standard shower. And like you said to me, Sinead, where would they erect that here in the desert? So the 2 buckets as your shower was, something that I wasn't used to. So.
But it's good to experience that. And that's where you have to go to these places. And, you know, it shows you how much you actually need to have some bit of comfort as well. And just what you said there about knowing you'd finished day 3 and day 4, I found day 3 was really, really difficult. And in my head, because I'd been in sand dunes before, I knew it was going to be energy draining, and I expected to maybe use a lot more water on this day.
When we got to day 3 and the sand dunes, and you were thinking, okay, that was difficult for you, but like, I knew for me that the sand dunes, like, I have a lot of strength in my legs, and that's what makes me a good ultra runner. And even the amount of strength that I had in my legs, I found it very energy sapping going up those sand dunes. And there was one point where we were climbing up, and all I kept thinking was, I'm slipping, I can't do this. I just actually physically can't lift my leg. And I was thinking to myself, okay, what's wrong with me? Like, where is the strength gone from my legs? Like, my legs should be a lot stronger than this. So I was getting a bit disappointed in myself, but I was getting disappointed in myself. But I knew that that there wasn't any hope of me stopping, because all I kept saying to myself was, if you could do yesterday, which was very, very difficult, you can definitely do today. And I wasn't as anxious about the day three in the sand dunes, because I knew that if I fell, even from the height of the sand dune, I wasn't going to really injure myself, because it was only sand. Now, I suppose I was a small bit worried about the sand getting into the wound, because the bandage kept coming off. So that was kind of more my worry than the worry of, okay, will I finish this? All I just kept thinking is, how do I keep this wound clean to get to the finish line? And I remember the first aid station on the sand dunes, by the time we got to the first aid station, the doctor was there and the bandage was coming off, and he was quite worried about me continuing on with the sand getting into the wound. And I just said, no, I'm finishing this. And then he said, okay, I'll put on the bandage. He put on the bandage, and sure, we were no sooner gone from the aid station and the bandage started coming off again. And I remember you saying, do you want to go back? And I said, no, because the time, I suppose I was, the competitiveness was coming out of me then, because I knew that there was a good few runners from behind us and that they'd overtake if I went back. So the competitiveness was coming out of me. I don't know, just the first day one and day two, I just felt I didn't feel that feeling of competitiveness, but it definitely came out in day three, and I enjoyed the sand dunes even though kept slipping. And it definitely is energy sapping. No matter how strong a runner you think you are, you definitely get grounded by the sand dunes.
And the sand dunes were actually the biggest I'd ever experienced, and this gives me an opportunity to just talk a little bit about the gear. Sinead was using walking poles, which do help when you're going uphill and up a sand dune. We also had these gaiters on our running shoes. Now, the gaiters are specifically to keep out sand. They're not your traditional hill walking gaiters that are used to protect against the rain and maybe putting your foot into a bog hole. So these, it's a very light material, but it keeps the sand out. There's elastic on the top, and then there's Velcro on the bottom part, which helps secure it to your running shoe. So you have to get a strip of Velcro. You have the male and female side, so you get the male side stitched onto your running shoe, and then you Velcro the gaiter on. Now, the first 2 days, because we're in a desert, you're expecting there to be sand. So we, as did everyone else, we all wore our gaiters for the first 2 days. But what I noticed then at the end of the first day was that the gaiter was starting to get scuffed, and it was coming away from the Velcro, because of the fact that we were kicking rocks, and it was a bit of abrasive, and it was starting to wear away. And again, it happened a bit on day two. So what we did on day two was we undid the gaiter from our shoe and we left it loose. So then when we were in the sand then the following day, it does help to stop the sand from getting into your shoes. If the sand gets into your shoes, that's when you have a really strong possibility of getting blisters. Previously, we'd both been in the Atacama Desert and we were running without gaiters. And I can remember there was one day that we ran down a sand dune, and as the sand gets into your shoe, it actually gathers underneath your foot, and it'll start to kind of go like a ball underneath your foot, and it'll start to push your foot upwards. And it's almost like you're trying to run with something solid inside your shoe, and gets very, very uncomfortable. So if you're going somewhere like this, gaiters for your shoes are an essential. So eventually we got to the top of this really, really big sand dune. There's one that was just enormous. It was the same as climbing a mountain. And any time you'd stop going up, you were starting to sink back down again. Sinead just said that she knew that if she fell in the sand that she wouldn't hurt herself because it was just sand. Well, two things. It will hurt your morale, first of all, if you roll down the sand and you have to start climbing again. But it was one side where it was so steep that you would have continually fell or rolled down. And then when you get to the bottom part where it started to level out, you would actually feel a bit of an impact there. And it's the kind of spot where you would see the sport of sandboarding, which is similar to snowboarding. Anyway, so we got to the top of the sand dune, and then we had kind of a gentle slope to one side that we were able to just let loose and run down. It was like being on top of a roller coaster where the mechanism has brought the roller coaster up and then gravity just brings it down. So that was nice. And we knew then that if we fell going down this stretch, that it was no big deal. I might get a bit of sand in the hair, but you wouldn't be expecting to get injured. And then it started to level out again as we kind of turned off to at an angle. And I think that's when I really started to notice the fatigue in my legs. It was the effort for climbing up and then the fast running down.
I think the reason why we ran down fairly fast was because when we were climbing up that steep part, I said to you, is there anybody behind us? And you said, oh, they're back a good bit. And then that mentally calmed me down, knowing that, okay, I can take my time at this. But there was points where I just felt that I just cannot move my leg here. I just can't climb up this. And then you then said that the competitors were quite close now. And so when you had said that they were quite close now, that competitiveness, anxiety came into me, as in I just started panicking as to how close they were. So that got me moving. And so I said to myself, okay, if I can get to the top here very quickly, try and get to the top before them, I can have a short breather and then you can just run down or even roll down. And so that was my mini goal for that moment, was to get to the top before those competitors. And then once at the top, then if you fall, you fall. Like, I suppose, like you were saying, that if had we fallen and slipped backwards, it would have been very disheartening having to climb it all again. And thankfully that didn't happen. So we were using a strategy of putting our feet into other people's footprints, and that was actually working a small bit now, not all the time, because just sometimes you put your foot into other people's footprint and it would just, the sand would all slide away. But there was a good few times where that was actually creating like a staircase.
And then the footprint started to disappear. And the sand dune was starting to shift a bit because the wind was picking up as we got to the top, if you remember.
Yeah. And then we went down, and then there was a few other sand dunes, and then we kind of came to a part that was very flat and dusty. And then there was smaller sand dunes that you had to go up and down, so they weren't as bad. And then I was catching other competitors in the race, and so for me then the third day was starting out of the whole 3 days so far, it was working out really well, because as in just that confidence was coming back to me and I was becoming very competitive, and I was trying to forget about my knee, the pain I was in, or trying to forget about the bandage falling off. And just as the competitive spirit was really, as I was kind of feeling very, very confident, the Jeep drove by us and said that we're actually stopping day 3 here today at 20k or 21k, I think it was 20k, rather than going on to 32k because of the sandstorm was getting very bad. Now, at that point, when the Jeep had come towards us, we had to, it's important to have a buff to be protecting your nose and your mouth from all the sand blowing into you, and having the sunglasses on to try and stop all the sand and the dust going into your eyes, because the sandstorm was quite bad. But I was kind of disappointed in some ways, because I just wanted to see, was there more competitors that I could overtake in that final 10, 12 kilometres? But in the end, I do think it was the right decision by Mohammed, the safety of all race competitors because of the sandstorm getting quite bad.
So we got a lift back to the camp. And actually, while we were on our way back, we met the Paris to Dakar race. That's motorbikes and trucks. We met them as we were on the way back. Then we got to our camp, and the camp hadn't been set up. So we had a bit of a wait before we could get access to our tents and have a lunch and that. But we had a bit of time to kind of walk around the general area. And I was feeling drained at that time, even though we stopped that bit early. So again, the usual procedure was, Sinead went to the medic tent, she got herself sorted out. We then had to kind of go through a bag, sort out our gear for the next day, fill your bottles, check your feet, prepare your clothes, pack your bag, get your sleeping bag and mat out, go for lunch, have a wash. And that was typically what we did every day. And then we were getting prepared then for the fourth and final day. Yeah.
And then something that I wasn't expecting. Normally, anybody who knows me knows that I suffer with a lot of blisters on my feet. I didn't get blisters on my feet at all. But I got blisters on my hands from using the poles so much. So I wasn't actually really expecting that. So I had to kind of bandage up my hands a small bit. And yes, like you say, the procedure always was the minute I come over the finish line to try and go and find the medics to try and clean out all the sand and dust and everything out of the wound and get the dressing changed. The fifth day, I suppose I found that difficult, but it was also exciting because I knew I was on the last day and I knew that no matter what I was, since I got to day four, that I was going to complete it. And there was a lot of different terrain. There was kind of gorse, bushes all lined out in different sections. Then there was slippy, it was like melted chocolate towards the end. There was stones and everything. So there was, I suppose, when I couldn't fully see all this, it's hard to remember, have that visual in my head. So you'll probably be able to describe the different terrain better.
Well, just as you mentioned there, yeah, it was fairly flat relative to the previous days. And I think we did start off with some climbs again over some sand dunes, and then we made our way down to, it was almost a dried up river. It was very muddy, and that's what we were walking on, and the texture was like a melted chocolate.
And you could nearly slipped a few times, and you could see that people, well, I couldn't see, but you could see that people had slipped previous, because you would have been able to see the marks on the...
And that actually made it easy with route selection. I could scout on up ahead and have a look at where those marks, skid marks were in the riverbed. And previous to that, when we were running, we could, if I spotted the competitor up ahead, I'd look at the general direction they were going, and that would save time on the navigation.
Yeah, because there was marker flags that you were trying to find, and it wasn't always easy to find those marker flags. And I suppose if I had been there myself, doing it myself, there wouldn't have been a hope at all that I would have seen those flags whatsoever.
But I kind of knew the general direction that we should be going in, especially when we were heading towards a town. Chances are the river was going to be headed to that town. So for the most part, we stayed along the river. And then I can remember seeing the outskirts of the town just as we left the river. And it seemed so close, but we must have been running for over an hour trying to get to that point where I could see the outskirts of the town to actually reaching the town. Then we arrived onto one of the streets just as we left the desert, and that seemed to go on forever.
Yeah, well, before we got onto that street, the last checkpoint that we had, I think it was around 30k, and the people at that checkpoint were congratulating me, saying, "This is the best you've ran in the last 4 days." I think they were saying that because of different competitors that I had overtaken, etc. So I suppose getting that boost of confidence towards the end at the 30k mark really spurred me on to get to the finish.
And then we went up the main street, came to a roundabout. And with the roundabout, there were two roads leading off it, and I didn't know which one to take. So I then decided on taking the most obvious one and staying on the main road. but I couldn't see any markers. And I can then remember we going for maybe a kilometre and I still hadn't seen a marker, and I was wondering, did we go the wrong way? I was then thinking, should I go back? You know, I mentioned to Sinead that I hadn't seen a marker because I was starting to get worried at this stage. And my thoughts were, leave Sinead there, go back and check to see if there's another marker, or should I go back with Sinead? Like, which would be the most time efficient? Would it be best to me run back and then come back again and get Sinead, or the two of us go? But luckily, moments later, I did actually see a marker on the ground pointing us in the direction we needed to go, and we were so, so close to the actual finish that if I had turned around at that point, it would have been a nightmare. So we got towards the finish. We could hear the others from the race. They were out cheering us on, and they could see us coming. We did a lap of the hotel we were staying in and then crossed the finish line, and that was relief.
Yeah, for me it was a lot of emotions crossing that finish line, mainly just feeling proud of myself that I got there to the finish, and just also feeling proud of us as a team, knowing that I wouldn't have got to the finish unless you have a good teammate. And I think that's important in life, having good teammates. So that was really good. And it's a race that I would suggest to anybody out there, if you love trail running, to definitely consider this race, because there's a selection of different terrain. You get to experience the culture, the environment. So you don't just get to experience the race, you get to experience many different things. So I'd highly recommend to anybody to do it, because it was just a worthwhile experience.
I think I'm going to wrap it up now. And before we finish, this is the first podcast that we've done together. And we've done so many races together. So this worked out a bit better than I was expecting. It started off a bit slow, but then we got into it because I wasn't really planning on involving you in it too much. But I think it's out there working out well. So maybe we can go back at some stage and revisit some of the other races we did, maybe seven marathons, seven continents, 7 days, the World Marathon Challenge. And then there's also the Atacama Desert, which you do talk about quite a lot. So maybe we can revisit those two races again. Now, for anybody listening in, if you enjoyed this or any of the other podcasts, you might consider leaving a review, passing it on to a friend. That's who I know it's worthwhile actually doing it, if someone's actually listening to them. And I'm just glad I found the time to actually put this one together. So that's all for now, and maybe Sinead will be back on the next one. Okay,
thank you. You never know.